don't know me, my name's Brenda, and I'm married to Chris, and we have two children, Jamie, who is 10, and Caitlin, who's 12. Caitlin has a diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder and dyspraxia and sensory processing disorder, and hopefully by the end of the evening you'll have a little bit more of an idea of what that all means. What we really hope to achieve tonight is to give you an overview of what some of these additional needs are, and also to convey a very real sense of what family life is like and the daily struggles that we might face. We'll all be speaking from our own personal perspectives. I know that there are a lot of different opinions or views on the correct language or terms to use in relation to additional needs, so please bear in mind that we're all using terms that feel right for us. Before we start, I'll just give you a very quick overview of what we're going to go through this evening. I'm going to start off giving you a brief description of what autism spectrum disorder and sensory processing disorders are. We'll then move on to a demonstration of what sensory processing disorder feels like, which Katie's going to organise for us. We'll then have a time of sharing. Four of us are going to share a little bit about our journeys. And after that, there will be time for questions. So if you think of anything during the evening that you want to ask, please just make a note of it, and we'll come back to that after we've finished sharing. After that, I'm going to hand over to Lucy, who's going to lead us in a time of worship and reflection, and there'll also be prayer ministry available. So, autism spectrum disorder. It's also called autism spectrum condition, either ASD or ASC, depending on which term you prefer. The current general diagnosis is autism spectrum disorder, and this includes things like high-functioning autism, Asperger's, PDD, NOS, atypical autism. All those diagnoses that you may have heard over the years now come under the one umbrella of autism spectrum disorder. So when I say ASD tonight, I'm using that as an umbrella term for all those different diagnoses. The National Autistic Society describe autism as a lifelong developmental disability that affects how a person communicates with and relates to other people. It also affects how they make sense of the world around them. All the people on the spectrum share certain difficulties, but the condition does affect each individual in different ways. There are three main areas of difficulty that everybody on the spectrum shares to differing degrees, and these are called the triad of impairments. The first area is social interaction, and this includes the social and emotional aspects of life. And difficulties in this area can lead to difficulties in friendships, managing unstructured parts of the day, and working cooperatively. The second area is that of social imagination or flexibility of thought, and this can lead to difficulties with coping with changes in routine. Being empathetic towards other people, they may have trouble working out what other people might be thinking, and also generalization of ideas. For example, it can be quite difficult for a school child who's used to doing schoolwork at school to then cope with the idea of doing homework, because schoolwork should be done at school. And it's hard to transfer that idea of schoolwork to home, so it's quite common for children on the spectrum to struggle with doing homework. The third area is social communication, and this includes the use of language and verbal and non-verbal communication. And this can lead to struggles with processing and retaining verbal information, and difficulty understanding things like jokes and sarcasm, difficulty understanding the social use of language, and often very literal interpretation of language. And I can remember the first time I really noticed that with Caitlin, when I said to her, you know, she's got this really curly hair and it was all sticking out, and I said to her, oh, you look like you've been dragged through a bush backwards. And she sort of went, well, do I have twigs in my hair? And of course she'd taken me completely literally. They may also have difficulty with understanding other people's body language, facial expression, and with gesture. It's really important to understand that autism is a spectrum disorder. There is a huge range of abilities on the spectrum. So at one end you have half-functioning autism or Asperger's, and right at the other end you have what's often been referred to as classic autism or Kanner's autism. And there will be people who live independently, perfectly happily, and there will also be people at the other end of the spectrum who have severe learning disabilities and will need a lifetime of specialist support. People with autism have said that the world to them is a mass of people, places, and events which they struggle to make sense of and which can cause them considerable anxiety. And anxiety is, in my experience of research and knowing people on the spectrum, anxiety is a huge struggle. It's certainly a huge struggle with my daughter. In particular, understanding and relating to other people and taking part in everyday family and social life may be harder for them. Other people appear to know intuitively how to communicate and interact with each other. And some people with autism may wonder why they are different. We all tend to socialize intuitively. We instinctively know what to do and what to say. We don't have to think about it. But people on the spectrum have to communicate cognitively. They have to think about everything that they say, everything that they do, which makes it a pretty exhausting process for them. This is a very, very brief overview of ASD. If you want any more information, the National Autistic Society website is a really good place to start. They've got very comprehensive information on there, and it's written in accessible language. It's very easy to understand. So if you want any more information, then do go and have a look at that. I'm going to move on now to sensory processing disorder. It's also called sensory integration dysfunction. The more modern term is sensory processing disorder, so I'm going to talk about that this evening, or SPD for short. And the main reason that we wanted to include this is that it's such a huge struggle for lots of children, not just children on the spectrum, but children with ADHD, dyslexia, dyspraxia. Also, it can stand alone as a disorder, so it's actually probably far more common than people think. But it's not very well understood, so we really wanted to explain it, and it does impact the children a lot at church. So first of all, what is sensory processing? If you're anything like me, you wouldn't have heard that term before. I certainly didn't until I took Caitlin to an occupational therapy appointment when she was first diagnosed. And sensory processing refers to the way the nervous system receives messages from the senses and turns them into appropriate motor and behavioral responses. Whether you are biting into a hamburger, riding a bicycle, or reading a book, your successful completion of the activity requires processing sensation or sensory integration. So that's what sensory processing is. Sensory processing disorder is a neurological disorder that results from the brain's inability to integrate certain information received from the body's sensory system. The individual reacts in an extreme way to normal things that he or she experiences. It varies between individuals, both in characteristics and intensity. Children may be born hypersensitive, so they're over-responsive to stimuli, or hyposensitive, they are under-responsive to stimuli. And both of these can result in avoidance of a particular activity. And you can also be hypersensitive in one sense and hyposensitive in another, just to make things really confusing. Individuals can have trouble in just one sensory modality, a few or all of them, and some people are so mildly affected that the disorder is barely noticeable, and others are so impaired that they have trouble with daily functioning. So what does this mean for the individual? How does this feel, and why does it cause such daily struggles? Stanley Greenspan, in his book, The Challenging Child, explained it like this. Imagine driving a car that isn't working well. When you step on the gas, the car sometimes lurches forward and sometimes doesn't respond. When you blow the horn, it sounds blaring. The brakes sometimes slow the car, but not always. The blinkers work occasionally. The steering is erratic, and the speedometer is inaccurate. You are engaged in a constant struggle to keep the car on the road, and it is difficult to concentrate on anything else. Jean Ayres is an American occupational therapist and educational psychologist, and she pioneered the research into sensory integration, and she offers this description. Imagine the brain as a large city with lots of traffic. Well-developed sensory integration means that the traffic flows smoothly and everyone gets to their destination on time. Sensory integration dysfunction is like a traffic jam in the brain. Some bits of sensory information get tied up, and parts of the brain do not get the information they need to do their job. Life is difficult enough for those who cannot see or who cannot hear. It can be even more difficult if you are unable to understand and make sense out of what you see, hear, or touch. So what does this all mean for daily life? I'm going to go through some examples of difficulties that can arise from the different senses, some of the common issues. For sensory integration, there are actually 7 sensory systems. So in addition to the 5 senses that we're all familiar with, there's the proprioceptive sense and the vestibular sense, which I will explain in a couple of minutes. First of all, the tactile sense, the sense of touch. Individuals can be sensitive to clothing textures and clothing labels. They dislike having their hair brushed or washed. They may react badly to being touched unexpectedly and usually sensitive to being too hot or too cold. So if you imagine, if you're wearing a top that has a really scratchy label, as you go through the day, you can generally just ignore it. You can kind of carry on with the important things in your day. But for a child whose sensory system is not working properly, they are unable to kind of rise above that sensation. So it will worry them all day quite severely. They can't just move past it and forget about it. The visual sense, the sense of sight, they can become overwhelmed in a visually busy environment. They focus on little details rather than the whole picture. It's difficult to take in information from a whole picture. They may lose their place frequently when copying from the blackboard. If you picture a typical primary school classroom, there are big, bold displays all around. There are pictures that the children have made. And for the majority of the children, that looks wonderful. But for a child who is suffering from sensory overwhelm, they just can't screen all that extra information out, and it becomes visually overwhelming. Auditory, the listening sense, they have a very low tolerance of noise generally. They say that noise hurts their ears or gives them a headache. Or they seem not to register sound at all. Sometimes they will completely shut down because the noise is just too much. And they may fail to respond to hearing their name called. The oral sense, the sense of taste and texture in the mouth. Often people are fussy eaters, they may have very determined food preferences and a very limited range of things they may eat. Or on the other hand, they may lick, taste, or chew on inedible objects and often dislike toothpaste or brushing their teeth and or brushing their teeth. I can remember Caitlin as a 2-year-old lying on the beach in South Africa on her side like the scooping sand into her mouth, which for the majority of us sounds absolutely revolting, and crunching on that sand would be a horrible sensation. But she's got a very under-sensitive oral sense. So for her, that sensation actually made her feel more normal. And we still think that her very robust immune system has got something to do with the amount of times we found her licking the bottom of her shoe. The olfactory sense, the sense of smell. They may be disturbed by cooking, bathroom, or perfume smells, or they may not notice unpleasant or noxious odors at all, or be able to distinguish smells or fragrances. I can remember, again, Caitlin as a small child, if there was a baby who had soiled its nappy, she would go back to the mum continually saying, are you going to change your baby's nappy now? Are you going to change your baby's nappy now? And we now understand that was because the smell for her was just so overpowering. Vestibular sense, this is the sense of movement. A child with an overactive vestibular sense will avoid playground apparatus and equipment. They may be fearful of heights. On the other hand, if the child has an underactive vestibular system, which Caitlin has, they may crave movement experience, especially fast or spinning movement, and they are a thrill seeker. And she likes nothing better than to go on all the biggest and the best roller coasters at the theme parks, which is great for me because I love them too, so we do that together. The proprioceptive sense is the sense of body position. They have difficulty understanding where their body is in relation to other objects. So if you close your eyes, you can still know where your hand is. But children who have difficulties with the proprioceptive sense wouldn't know where their hand was unless they were actually looking at it. They just don't have that sense of body position. They may appear clumsy, they may bump into things, and often misjudge the weight of an object. In addition, there are many general behaviours and traits that are associated with sensory processing disorder. For example, agitation, frustration, aggression, low self-esteem, difficulty unwinding or sleeping, and appearing out of sync with self or others and the environment. So that's a little bit about sensory processing disorder. I know it's quite a lot to take in. The National Autistic Society, again, on their website, has a really, really good section on sensory difficulties. So if you want to look up more on that, that's a very good place to start, and the address is there on your handout. Over the years, with various courses we've been on and... we have a bug. Various courses we've been on and research that we've done, there have been a few things that... If somebody doesn't know Caitlin at all, and I very quickly need to say to them, this is what you need to do, these are the sort of things that I would tell them. Make sure that you have their attention before you speak. Use their name. If you just talk, the likelihood is that they won't hear you, they won't listen to you. Very important to use their name, make sure you have their attention before you speak. Don't speak too fast. And allow time for them to process what you've said. It will take them longer to understand the language that you've used, so do allow them time to process. Use as few words as possible to get your point across. Keep sentences short and to the point. If you use 20 words to explain something that you could have explained in 5 words, you've just made them work 4 times as hard to understand that language. So it's really important to keep things short and to the point. You're not being blunt, you're helping them. The other thing is to tell them what to do and not what not to do. So for example, you need to walk, not don't run. And we found this to be really, really useful because if we said, for example, if Caitlin was fiddling in a shop and she's a terrible fiddler, we'd say to her, stop fiddling, and she'd just ignore us and carry on. But then we learned to say to her, put your hands in your pockets, because then she knew what to do with her hands. If you didn't tell her what to do, she didn't know what to do. So really important to say what they should be doing rather than what they shouldn't be doing. One of the things that I found when I was chatting to friends about what to include this evening, one question that kept coming up was, how do I explain autism to my child? And I was reading through various things on the internet, and I came across a blog which has, I think, the best analogy I've ever heard to explain. This is particularly about autism, but I think it actually works really for any difference. So I'm just going to read it out to you. I think it's brilliant. This is a mum who put this together to explain autism to her child's class. Having autism means that your brain is put together differently. Your brain still works perfectly well. It just does things differently from other people's brains. Let's think about the brain as a machine. You know that your brain controls everything you do. You use your brain to think about things and to make your body do things. Your brain also controls things that you don't even think about. You don't have to remember to breathe because your brain does it automatically for you. You don't have to remember to blink because your brain does it. So sometimes you use your brain to do things, and sometimes your brain just does things because that's what it's wired to do. The same thing is true in autism. But because there are differences in the way the brain is connected, there are differences in the way the brain reacts to things. Let's pretend your brain wasn't made of tissue and neurons and nerve cells, but instead it was made of metal and plastic and electric wires. And when you put that together, it turned into a toaster. Let's pretend that most of us had toaster brains. Some of us might make white toast and some wheat toast or rye toast. Some of us might make light toast and some of us dark toast. Some of us might only toast bagels. And sometimes we might even burn the toast. But for the most part, all of our brains would be able to do the same thing, make toast. Now, think about this pretend world we have created. In our world, most people have toaster brains. So when we make the rules for our world and decide how we want to spend our time, what do you think we'll decide is the most important thing a person can do? Make toast, of course. Because we have brains that are really good at making toast. So we want to have a world where it's really important and really valuable to make toast, right? Now let's pretend that Bud's brain is also made of metal and plastic and electrical wires, just like our brains, except that when his metal and plastic and electrical wires get put together, they turn into a totally different kind of machine. Instead of being a toaster, Bud's metal and plastic and electrical wires turn into a hairdryer. Now, there's nothing wrong with a hairdryer. Hairdryers are great. There are some things that hairdryers are really good for. There are some things that a hairdryer can do even better than a toaster. But it is really, really hard to make toast with a hairdryer. So in our pretend world, even though Bud has a perfectly wonderful hairdryer brain, it's going to be hard for him because we toaster-brained people have decided that the most important thing that people do in our world is to make toast. And Bud probably can make toast with his hairdryer, but he's going to have to work a lot harder to make toast with his hairdryer brain than we will with our toaster brains. It'll probably take him a lot longer to make his toast. And no matter how hard he works, his hairdryer toast will probably always look different from our toaster toast. But on the other hand, think about this. When we toaster-brained people have wet hair, we are really going to hope that Bud and his hairdryer brain are around. I really love that. I'm now going to hand over to Katie, who is going to give us a demonstration on what sensory processing disorder might feel like.
Right, so that was the science bit. This is the fun bit. Not, science isn't fun. Got to be careful how I say that. Right, so we know that I'm going to talk specifically about sensory processing disorder in this bit. Sensory processing disorder, as we heard, is where your brain struggles to cope with the input from your senses. Now, James, my son James, has autism, but it's his sensory processing that is really, really bad. And it's James's sensory processing disorder, really, that stopped him being in mainstream school, even with a full-time one-on-one carer. Teaching assistant, full-time statement, he couldn't manage full-time school, and it's why he really, I'm saying this in family, he hates church, really doesn't like church at all. And hopefully this is going to explain why he really struggles in those environments. I mean, something I hadn't thought to say in this, but what Brenda said is pictures on the walls. I took James into the school the church school, and his eyes nearly fell out of his head because it's just children's artwork on the wall. But his eyes were honestly darting around like they were going to fall out of his head because he just, and that was that alone. But anyway, I digress. So I'm basically going to demonstrate sensory overload by giving it to someone. So I have my willing volunteer who I will call up in a minute. Now, well, I say willing, he doesn't really know what I'm doing to him. Anyway, so imagine you're in a situation where you have to concentrate on something. Imagine you are trying to learn in school, or you are sitting down and listening to, say, for sake of argument, Simon giving a sermon. Only backtrack one. For James, the act of sitting still and listening to one person is next to impossible, because sensory processing aside, James's brain is like, ooh, why are those Bibles stacked that way? Let's go and, oh no, I can't, I've got to sit here. Why is that light reflecting like that? Let's go, oh no, I've got to sit here. Ooh, what's down there? No, I've got to sit here. Seriously, that woman's perfume is so strong. Does that make sense? All sensory aside, for James, just sitting still, it takes so much effort of willpower. Right, okay, so that aside. So we're all in a situation where we have to concentrate on something that's quite challenging. So, Andrew, please could you go and stand at the microphone? Oops, what was that? So, to give us a sense, I've got something that I think is really quite challenging. This is my A-level English literature copy of Geoffrey Chaucer's A Wife of Bath. Anybody read it? Oh, you sad suckers, right. So it was, I'm telling you, I hated this with a passion. I'm surprised I didn't burn it. So this was written, and I looked it up for you. This was written in 1386 and forms part of the Canterbury Tales. And it's written in Middle English. And our A-level class used to look forward to Shakespeare because it was accessible compared with this. So Andrew, could you read, say the first five sentences just to give sensible people who haven't read this.
In the old days of the King Arthur, of which that Briton spick and greet honour, all this was land fulfilled of fairy. The elf queen with her jolly company danced full oft in many a green mead. This was the old opinion, as I read. I speak of many hundred years ago. But now can no man say non-elves mow, for now the great charity and prayers...
Do we get the idea? Sorry, Andrew. That was boring me. Right. So we're concentrating on that, right? But at church or in the classroom, there's background chatter, right? There's children working away and interacting before the service. There's people talking to each other, right? So can I have two volunteers? If they're volunteers, I'm going to pick people. Okay, Sarah Jarvis and Lizzie Cronin, could you please, nicely, go and stand on either side of Andrew, looking at each other, with Andrew in the middle? I should have chosen taller people. Never mind. When I say go, and I'm not a control freak, but I like it done properly. When I say go, could you two talk to each other across, I really should have picked all the people. Not. Could you talk to each other across him? Thank you. If you run out of conversation, just recite song lyrics or say rhubarb and custard. I just need a constant stream of words coming out of your mouth. Okay. Right. Right, I need another volunteer. Kate Greenstock. Come and annoy your husband in the name of science. I need you to go, come to me first. I need you to go up and stand behind him, and I need you to tap him on his back. I don't want you to hurt him, because I do not want to cause him pain, but I want you to really grate on him. Can you feel how hard?
Yeah.
Go, get ready. Because in church or in a classroom environment, people brush against each other, right? You have to sort of slide past someone, you sort of touch their arm as you walk around, or you knock into them, or, you know, we body contact, right? But for a child with sensory processing, that can actually be almost painful or very unpleasant at the very least. It's like, oh, get off me, yuck. So that's... he's too tall. Never mind. Right, I need one more volunteer. Thank you. Right, light. We've discussed, haven't we, that light can actually be painful, can actually be, even on a day when the sun isn't particularly shining, you'll be squinting, right? And flashing light would just mess with your brain. So can you shine that in his face? I have literally picked a little team of Oompa Loompas around the giant in the middle. And this little bottle of pleasure is aquarium-grade ammonia. When you have sensory processing disorder, smells get you. Rick and I aren't allowed to eat in the car with James because he literally, the smell of our food, he just can't cope with it at all. Even pleasant smells will just dominate his brain so much. He's looking this way and concentrating, but his brain is just being, what on earth is that? The best way I can visually, have you ever seen one of those cartoons where you get like a scent and you can see it visually and it's like this sinuous snake that goes and kind of grabs people by the nose and sort of draws them? It's like that, honestly. Because this is evil stuff, I'm going to do it because I don't really want nice people. But the point is, in a church, people have pheromones. People just smell, not nastily, even if they're washed. And then on top of that, there's shampoos, conditioners, detergents, right? Is there anything else? Oh, yes. Background noise, music. In a church, before the service, there's the band practicing during the service. There's music afterwards. There's music while people are milling around. So, again, when I say go, Rick's going to play some ambient background noise, possibly not quite what we'd normally have in church, but you get the general idea. So I'm going to gradually bring everybody in, and then, Rick, if you could come in last, please. Okay, so, Andrew, could you start reading for me, please? To keep going.
That search in every land and every stream, as thick as moots in the sun abeam. Blessing house, chambers, kitchens, boors, cities, burghers, castles, he tours, thropes, burners, shippens, dairies, as maketh their path and no be varied. There as one to welcome was an elf, there walketh now the limiter himself, in undermels and in morning wellis, saith his matins and his holy things, as it gooth in his limitation. Women may now go saintly up and down in every bush or under every tree. There is no...
Do you get the point? Imagine you're my, as he was then, 5-year-old son learning to read, when every part of you is just being bombarded by stuff that messes with your head. And I mean, I couldn't even think of a way of demonstrating it, but yeah, imagine even just looking up from your workstation. And there's pictures everywhere. Do you know what I mean? So that is what sensory processing disorder. Thank you. And Andrew, thank you. You're a good sport. very quickly, thank you, guys. Just to talk about James. This is going to... So his photo makes me laugh. That's my boys, just before they went back to school. Do you notice how James is trying to unscrew Ben's head? It's like he's trying to... Anyway, Ben wasn't being that cooperative. So James was at a school in Ham and is now at a special school in Mitcham. And this is going to sound really negative about him, but he is funny and, I mean, really funny and clever and empathetic and kind and incredibly creative. He came home with a Nimbus 2000, a firebolt this evening that he is a broomstick from Harry Potter that they'd made at school today. His autism affects him in other ways other than his sensory processing, or really that's his main thing. I think James's biggest quirk, and the one that you'll probably notice most at church, is that he has no herd mentality at all. If he is in a room with 1,000 people and they are all sitting down, there is nothing in his psyche that will make him realise that he has to do that as well. Nothing, never occurred to him, even if, like other kids, even if they don't quite understand why they're doing it, they'd do it, right? Whereas James would just, if he didn't see why he shouldn't run around screaming, he just would run around screaming just because it's fun, right? Like at school, he would quite often, during assembly in his old school, he would listen for a bit. They'd put him at the back so the sensory stuff was deadened. But he'd just get up in the middle of assembly, thank the headmistress and just walk out and would be totally baffled as to why that was an issue and why they'd drag him back. Just wouldn't occur to him that that was a problem because he was bored and he'd had enough. James is very, very sociable, and he loves people. And if he can get what I always describe as a tame adult, someone who's just happy to talk to him one-on-one, he loves it, but he doesn't always understand people. He doesn't always quite get them, but he loves being around people. If you ever talk to him, you'll notice that he really controls the conversation. He has autistic, very narrow field of interest, and it's almost like he's got this like imaginary list, and if what you're talking about isn't on his list, he will just completely ignore you. If you're talking about something and you go off topic, he will bring you straight back again, or just wander off halfway through a conversation because you're boring him or you're weird. James is quite unusual for kids with autism because he's very, very eloquent. He's got a very, very good vocabulary, and his expressive language is very, very good. His social, I'm not a speech and language therapist, but his understanding of social language is quite weak. But we often tease him, that's just because he doesn't practice very much. I often laugh like, by that measure, I have crochet deficiency disorder. Does that make sense? Because I don't practice crochet, so I'm not very good at it. So in a way, we need to kind of get him doing it more. James controls conversations. If he plays with other children, he really controls their games. And the minute a child will try and like go off topic, he will or say, "Oh, I know, but what if the aliens come down?" He'd be like, "No, we're doing this." Or he'd, again, just wander off. It often breaks my heart when he and Ben interact, because James will be playing with his thing, doing his thing, like Lego, and Ben will come in and will fire a bit of conversation at James, and James will ignore it. If you looked at James and you were deaf, you would not know by his body language, his demeanour, anything that Ben is talking to him. Nothing would give you that indication. But literally, James will just ignore him. Ben will say something else. Ignored. Ben will say something else. I'm like, "James, your brother is talking to you. Can you respond?" And James will turn to me and goes, "Mummy, he's boring me. He's not saying anything of interest to me. I'm not listening." Of course, poor old Ben growing up with this. But do you see what I mean? It's just he's not interested, so he's not going to listen. Whereas if someone tried to talk to me about car mechanics, I'd at least pretend I was interested, right? But he doesn't have that. He's like, "You're boring me, I'm not interested." Kind of covered that one. Another autistic thing is that James loves things that rotate. Even as a baby, he used to turn his cars over and spin the wheels on the cars, or he'd lie down and watch the wheels go round as he pushed it along the carpet. He's obsessed with fans, with wind turbines, or winter blinds as they're called in our house, washing machines, because again, it's the rotation thing that he loves. James does have empathy. He's got amazing emotional intelligence. He cries at classical music. You have to be quite careful what you put on the radio, because I'll never forget, he was nearly his second birthday, I mean like a week before, and Fauré's Pavane came on and he burst into tears. He was like, "Muzzy!" Which is his little comforter. And I thought, "What on earth?" And gave him his Muzzy. And he just sat there with tears streaming down. He goes, "I'm like, what on earth has happened?" He went dancing sad. My two-year-old son crying at classical music. Amazing. But he doesn't always know what to do with it. So, like, you know those little tyke, yellow and red little tykes cars that you sit in and pedal along? You were here when this happened, weren't you? Our garden's quite uneven, and Ben's was in the car, and it fell over, and Ben was kind of half in and half out the car with his foot pinned into the floor. Ben was screaming and crying and stuck. James was there. I mean, literally next to him. I'm just playing with his toy, because it never occurred to him, Ben is stuck, therefore I should do something. It was just stop making noise, I'm busy. Does that, he just would never have occurred to him to help. It's hilarious. He hates things that are unpredictable. So static electricity, balloons, anything like that. And again, I don't quite get the balloon thing. Because at New Wine, for example, Bridget Clark was giving out balloons on bits of wool. Now, he went to Bridget on the first day and got a balloon and was running around with it. But then other people put balloons on the white gazebo in the middle of our village, and he wouldn't go within 10 foot of that gazebo for the entire New Wine. He would make a point of walking all the way around it, and wouldn't. And literally for most of New Wine, we were all in our tent because he wouldn't go near the village. If he's doing something he enjoys, he cannot stop. And he will often get violently angry because he just can't bear to bring himself away from what he's doing. And again, this is why he struggled in mainstream school, because it would take four people to stop him doing whatever. You know, there's no, right, children, we finished that, put those away, we're doing this now. He just couldn't manage that at all. James would rather soil himself than go to the toilet because he's enjoying his activities so much. Does that make sense? That is how kind of extreme that they can get. They're saying, no, I'm enjoying this. I don't want to stop doing this because this is what I'm doing and it's fun. So, yeah, that's kind of a bit of us anyway.
I've now been a parent of a child with special needs for long, for the greater part of my life, for longer than I was beforehand. And so, I mean, my day-to-day experience now is quite different. My daughter is 28. She lives with her fiancé in a flat in New Malden, and she can come on the bus to see us. But so I'm not at that point. But obviously, you go through lots of stages before you get here, and it isn't, I mean, life isn't solved when you're 28. Isn't solved in your 50s, and I suspect I won't have solved life when I'm in my 90s if I get that far. But I mean, we still, our experience is slightly different because Catherine has Down syndrome. Quite a lot of you know her, some of you know her very well. And so, our baby was born, and in 24 hours, we were told, you have a child with special needs, your future swaps then. And that has downsides and it has upsides. It's very hard thinking, are we just going to catch up? Is this is an issue? Is this just a phase we're going through? And I knew, do the test, you know, count the chromosomes, and you know where you are. And there's a lot to be said for that. It's very painful at the time, but you're there, and you know what you're dealing with. I mean, we had an added complication in that Catherine has translocation downs, and because we were both in our sort of mid-20s at the time she was born, we were relatively unlikely parents. So they tested for that, and you can be a carrier for that. So we went through something which is become increasingly complex for families now, genetic testing. You know, are we going to... Would you... we could have had a 25% chance of having another child with Down syndrome, and you have to make decisions. And that is that, and because of the way that you can test for single genes and tiny deletions now, there are a lot of issues, and that's a big deal for a lot of families, and something that is quite isolating. I mean, for us, it was relatively simple. We were lucky. We had 2 weeks waiting for the test. It was much, much quicker now. But, and neither of us were carriers of a translocation, so we don't go back to the normal expectation of having another child when we went on to have three other children. But, and I decided, well, we decided not to have tests on any further babies, because for me, I wouldn't want to say to my child, I love you, but I didn't want your sibling because I don't like you, but I wouldn't judge anybody. I have a friend who's actually now back in Indonesia who had two children with very, very rare degenerative disorder. She watched two children die, and it was a long, tough process. When her second daughter died, Edward was 9 months old, and that little girl was weaker, smaller, less able in every way at four, that was my 9 month old. And she was nursed and cared for, and her elder sister died in hospital, but with enormous support from King's Hospital, she died at home. And she unintentionally, later on, got pregnant, and she chose, when it was shown that this was going to happen again, she chose to have an abortion, and I would never, ever judge her. She was somebody who took God very seriously. She's Muslim. And I don't think you can make decisions for other people, but genetic testing is very, and it's enormously painful in families. Her friend, who's an identical twin, and decided to find out whether she carried the dominant gene for tuberous sclerosis, which is a pretty horrible thing, which you get tumours which can happen in the brain and cause epilepsy and all sorts of problems. She chose to have the test, her sister chose not to. And obviously the answer is the same for them because they're identical twins. And the most important thing was happening for both of them, they could not speak about. And she ended up, she carried it, and of her two children, one did and one didn't. And that's an enormous problem for families. There are great improvements in medical science, but it does make life difficult for some people. And there are some issues about, I mean, when we came to have Edward, it was scary. And Henry and Liz, who were then here, came and prayed with us. And the answer was not, I mean, he has the normal number of chromosomes. So the answer could, God could have said, yeah, it's fine. But actually, the answer was, you know, my ways aren't your ways. And, you know, we weren't promised anything. And I think the promise from God is to be with you, not that you're going to sort it. And you do spend your life thinking, at times, I mean, I think a lot of it I don't anymore because it's just who I am. But you spend time thinking, we're never going to be a normal family. And one of the things that helped me was the Hodgsons, who were very good friends of ours. You know, Dave, at that point, Sue's ME was much worse. I'm sure none of you can imagine why living with small babies and toddlers made chronic fatigue worse, but it did. And so we had the issue of, for Dave, it was very difficult for him that his family was never going to be normal because the mother wasn't right. And actually, I've yet to meet a normal family, but I'd love to meet one if you know one to introduce me. But it isn't how life is. No family is normal. Nothing is that simple. And everything is fine. It doesn't mean it isn't painful, but it is fine in the long run. And looking back on it, you know, I have, in the last few years, the children who have caused me most worry have been the other three. And I mean, not because they've done anything dreadful, but you know, when you're 20-year-old loves somebody and wants to spend their life with this person and that person does not love them, you can't solve it for them and you are very, very sad for them. And that's all in the past now, you know, new relationships, life's lovely, but that kind of thing can happen. And actually, in many ways, Catherine causes me less anxiety. Obviously, I worry about her. You always worry about your children. I'm sure Rosemary is still worrying about Rick, who is really quite a grown-up person these days. But, you know, this is how family life is. So I think it's important to remember that you think there is this perfect family that you are going to have and you don't have because your child is different. But actually, that isn't really true. But there are issues. And I have the experience of working every day with children with much more complex special needs than my daughter has. And it's, you know, life is very tough. I talked to a mother this morning who, in school, to move her child who cannot walk and can weight bear but doesn't always choose to and has regular seizures, we have two people and a hoist and a sling. At home, she is carrying him upstairs because in theory, there should be, the equipment should be installed. It hasn't happened. Life can be very, very tiring. And it can be tiring making it okay for other people because actually what you have to do is you have to be bright and smile and say, yes, my child has Down syndrome and she's lovely, which is true. But you are making it okay for other people quite a lot of the time. And you have, every time you embark on something, I can remember going for swimming lessons. And normally, for the others, you know, you see, you know, I wanted swimming lessons at 5 o'clock on a Thursday. Are there any spaces? So you start with that and then you say, and, you know, would you kindly consider having my child? Now, Catherine swims really well. She had 10 years of swimming lessons. Tim once tried to work out how much we'd spent on swimming lessons, and then he stopped because it was getting depressing. But it's worth. But they were worth every penny. She can swim front crawl, back crawl, breaststroke, and she can swim. You know, she'll go swimming for me. I swim faster than her, which is not true with any other men in my family, probably. But you know, it's she can. We can go and spend half an hour swimming up and down swimming lengths, and we can do that together, because she can do that, and it was worth paying for. But, yeah, I mean, life is very tiring. It's very difficult sometimes to get a babysitter, and that is something that church community can help with. I mean, actually, Catherine was very easy to babysit. A big Catherine, as we called her, Rosanna's Catherine, was one of a large number of people babysit, and she wasn't a problem. But there are people for whom it's an enormous problem. I think about a child I taught, because it was a pro who had really difficult seizures. You had to be able to give buccal midazolam within, you know, 2 or 3 minutes if he had his seizures. And I've sat on beside a road walking the sort of 5-minute walk from the German school back to the school where I taught from a swimming lesson with him going blue and then blue and grey, waiting for the ambulance to arrive. And that is scary. But you need someone who's prepared to take that on. You can't get the local teenager to that. Or they can't communicate. I spent yesterday morning in the multi-sensory impairment unit at the school where I teach, which is what used to be called the deaf-blind unit. And there's one girl there who is totally blind and totally deaf. So in order to communicate with her, she puts her hands on top of the hands of her intervener in school, whom she knows very well, and they sign, moving their hands together. But you need someone who can do that in order to be able to leave your child to go out for an evening. And all of us know what it's like being woken in the night, but for some families with children with special needs, that is a 30-year commitment, not a 2-year feeling like 30-year commitment. And one of the things that a lot of children with special needs have are medical issues. There are the seizures, which I talk about. Catherine was very ill just before and after her 4th birthday. I spent 3 weeks living in Kingston Hospital, and that was hard. She was seriously ill. William was 3 months old, and he was being totally breastfed, so he came in with us. But that meant leaving Ed, who was 2.5, at home on... abandoned, as far as he could see. I'd gone off with the other two children. Now, we had lovely grandparents to stay. I saw him every day. His father was there, but he was abandoned. And actually, it took him longer to get over the experience than it took his sister. And Catherine was really ill. And when they wake a consultant at 2:30 in the morning, you know that this is not normal. And it was scary. She could have died. And part of living a life with children with special needs is that children die. And that is a big part of the thing that's one of the big things that has separated my experience of parenthood from other people's experience of parenthood. That I know a lot of children who die. One of the children at my school died at half term. Another one died the term before. I've been to funerals. I went to a lovely funeral for an autistic child who was also had very severe epilepsy, and epilepsy does kill, where they ended with they got the fire engine round, because what he loved most was fire engines. And so his funeral ended with a fire engine. It is very, very hard. And that is totally out of most people's experience. As a church, we all remember, well, most of us remember Sebastian, and he died. But other children do. And that makes you feel like you live in a different world. You're moving around with all these other people and their world isn't your world. And I can remember thinking when I was expecting the second baby, you know, I'll do the first baby thing. I messed it up last time. You know, I spent all the time worrying about other things. But you can't, because you don't go back. I filled in an NCT survey. It was hilarious. There all these things that I was supposed to be upset about. You know, did you have stitches? Yes. Did you have this? Yes. And how do you feel about it? Ecstatic. And because it was fine. And it is hard for siblings. And I think that is something, it is really worth thinking. One of the things that helped us, we used to do days out. We don't do them anymore because they're quite grown up now. They're all in the 20s. But every child in the summer holidays got a day out with one parent doing what they chose And you did so. It started because I realised that Catherine couldn't cope with the Science Museum, but other people were ready for it. So you start thinking, and it because you have. I mean, we have where we've lived, and our holidays have been shaped by Catherine's needs to some extent. I'm sure Tim, we'd have moved house, and Tim would have been ahead of maths somewhere. He's not upset or unhappy about this, but we'd have moved, but we got education working. We weren't going to go. And, you know, there are holidays. We would certainly have done, say, cycling holidays with the children, but Catherine did learn to ride a bike, but only in a totally empty car park. She couldn't ride. She's probably lost the skill now, but she couldn't cope with, you know, we took her for a ride on the towpath once, for a very short ride on the towpath, because she could only manage if there was nobody else on it. And if you do that on a Sunday afternoon, it doesn't work. So children do have their days. And my other children love her dearly, and I will trust them to keep an eye on her when I'm not. In fact, she's the most unquestionably loved of the group of the four of them. They've all disliked each other at some point, but none of them ever disliked Catherine. Because she is calmer, and because it's often it isn't. I mean, I've had the scars to show. I've been bitten by a lot of children I've taught, but it's not done out of malice. If you're terribly, terribly upset and having a meltdown, you're not biting to hurt. Whereas I've seen children do something with no violence in mainstream, when I'm talking mainstream, which is really, really upsetting. You know, to a group of girls saying to another girl, your mum's not going to come and collect you today. I don't know why. And it wasn't until an hour after they'd started this, she burst into tears, and we found that out. Now, that really, really upset me, and upset me for days. The scar I have there from being bitten by somebody I know very well, it doesn't matter, because he wasn't trying to hurt me. He was just too upset to cope in the situation where he was at the time. And so that's different. There are issues about when people grow up, because life... Now, I have no right to make any decision for Catherine. I am involved in things, obviously, but I have no right, but I have total responsibility if something goes wrong. Because there is nobody else. I can remember talking to the people about statementing and schooling and trying to get something done. And I said, you know, it's very hard work in this office. People keep ringing us up. And I said, look, if you don't like it, you can leave. I can't leave. I'm here forever. And there are people who, for good reasons, have given up children for adoption. I talked to a family considering that once. And there are people who choose residential schooling for reasons that are good for them and good for their children and good for their other children. But parents don't leave. You're there. And it's difficult because there's part of me wants to organise her life and do it. And part of me doesn't, and I feel guilty if I interfere, and I feel guilty if I don't interfere, and you can't get it right, but she's very happy most of the time. And there are things, she'd like to have paid employment, and she hasn't got there, and I don't know if we'll ever get there, but it's certainly worth working for. I think she's certainly capable of it. But it's, you know, you would like to sort it out, and then you also know that you have no right to, because it's not my life, it's her life. And it isn't right for your mother to be sorting out what you do. So there are difficulties with that. There are difficulties in fitting into the world. In some ways, the world is easier for children. Apart from anything else, you have a statutory right to education. You have got to be educated. I can remember when children were classified as ineducable when I was a child, and there were children who just didn't go to school because they were not educable. Now, everybody has a right to that. But after the sort of post-19, and now it's edging further, it'll be post-25 now because of changes in the law, it is harder, and if there's pressure on money, there's pressure on money that keeps the benefits, on the services, on the things that are there. So that is a worry. Church was much better for Catherine when she was younger. Sally Butler was wonderful, and Catherine was part of everything. When Catherine came back from college, I did actually ring Simon and said, you know, what can Catherine join, what can Daphne be part of? And the answer is nothing. We are very, the Protestant church is very, very dependent on literacy. And Catherine is literate, but not, she wouldn't be able to sit and read a Bible, do a Bible study. And there is no group for her to belong to now here, whereas she's had years and years of being, I mean, she comes to church, and she, and there's lots of people she's really pleased to see. Katie's certainly one of the most important of them. But it's, you know, it's, this church isn't very good at that kind of thing, because we are obsessed with reading and writing. And I mean, I love reading and writing. That makes me happy. But we're not terribly good at places for adults for who, I mean, Catherine, I exchange texts regularly. She can use a list. She can look up and find out when X Factor's going to be on, and important things like that. But she's not going to be part of something that is totally based around reading. So that is an issue for the church. And, you know, life, there have been difficult bits. But, I mean, I've chosen to work with children with special needs because they're fun. I've been trying to explain to Lizzie about, because I'm bringing my children, we're doing special books, and I'm bringing them here to find out why the Bible is a special book. And trying to explain about the fact that none of them can talk, all of them use wheelchairs, none of them, they all have visual impairment, three of them are registered blind in my class, and, you know, and then there's the people who cheat, and there's the seizures, and there's the thing. But yeah, it all sounds terrible, but what doesn't convey is that they are people. They are wonderful people, they have characters, they have interests, and, you know, talking about James has always had and can make a wonderful music. Now, most of my children can't grasp and let go, because if you have, there's a lot of cerebral palsy and other issues. But they are lovely people to be with. I like going to work. I enjoy being with them, and it's fun. And I had a lovely lady who came in for her first day in a special school and got thrown in with us. And she had a good day, because they are wonderful people. And I think it's been a privilege. I won't want my life different. And Catherine has shaped me probably more than anyone else I've ever met. And I'm grateful for it. And you can't want somebody to be different, because they wouldn't be the person you love. It's illogical. And I think, I mean, the bit in the Bible I think is most useful about this, the bit in John, and I meant to look it up, the exact reference, and I forgot to do it before I came out, but you can find it, where they bring a blind man to Jesus, which is pretty interesting now, because now I'm trying to qualify as a teacher of those with visual impairment, and I work with people who are blind. But they bring this blind man to Jesus, and they say to him, who sinned? Was it him or was it his parents? And Jesus said, nobody did. He is like this so that the glory of God may be revealed. And we are not all the same. We are a group of people, and people with additional needs, with special needs. I mean, when Catherine was born, it was perfectly acceptable to say mental handicap. It'll change again before I'm... But I don't think for the people really involved, the words matter. What matters is actually, they are God's gift to us, and we are God's gift to them. And it is better for everybody, and God's glory is revealed in the fact that we're a very diverse group of people. And working for people, living with people with special needs, is a joy, and it's one of the things that we can celebrate as well as working out how to help, because it's not easy, but it is a celebration. Thank you.
Thank you, ladies. I'm going to talk a lot about myself, really, rather than Caitlin and the experiences that I've been through being her parent. It's always much easier to share positive stories with people, and although I do have an endless list of the amazing ways that God has been working in my life in relation to being Caitlin's mum, Today I want to share something different. I want to get into the nitty-gritty, the dark places, my dark places, of parenting a child with additional needs. These places that aren't so easy to share and also aren't very easy to understand if you haven't experienced it. And please bear in mind that I'm describing things solely from my own point of view. This is how I feel and may bear no relation to how other people feel in my position. I grew up in middle-class white South Africa, where diversity or difference really wasn't something I ever considered. I didn't know anyone who wasn't pretty similar to us, and there were no children with learning disabilities in mainstream schools. I had very low self-esteem growing up, and I always did my best to stick to the rules, not to stand out, to be the same, never different. My one experience of learning difficulties and disabilities was working in what I can only describe as an institution during my nursing training. And that experience of seeing all the poor people who were institutionalized and treated like objects rather than humans still haunts me. I grew up with the idea that these differences were something to be ashamed of and hidden away. And as you can imagine, these experiences weren't a very good foundation for having a child with additional needs. Caitlin was diagnosed with dyspraxia and sensory processing disorder when she was 4, and then she was officially diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder at the age of 7, because there was a 2.5-year waiting list for her to be formally assessed for that. And just very quickly to touch on dyspraxia, it's kind of a branch of sensory processing disorder, and it affects anything to do with planning. So motor planning, thought processes, language, all sorts of different things. I would love to stand up here and describe how it has been an amazing and fulfilling journey raising Caitlin, and how I would never have her any other way, but the truth is that I can't. There have been amazing and fulfilling times, but if I could do something to take away her disabilities and make the world an easier place for her to live in, I would do it in a heartbeat. The harsh reality is that the journey has been harder than I could ever have imagined. And I thought when she was first diagnosed that I would somehow get used to it and I would reach a point where I could say that I had fully accepted how she is and her differences. And whilst that is true to an extent, the reality is that she is a hairdryer kid in a toaster-brained world. And you now all know what I mean by that. As hard as I try, the world just isn't going to change its view that making toast is the most important activity. So I have to try and help Caitlin live the best life that she can, despite how hard it is for her to make toast. The reason I love that analogy so much is that it really sums up the world of neurodiversity so well, because it explains how difference is not less, but how living in the world as it is today, when you are different, is really, really hard. And I think it's even harder for the children who are in mainstream schools, because they are expected to behave the same as all the other children and do all the same work and meet all the same targets and everything like that. I do often find caring for Caitlin relentless and exhausting. Every single aspect of our lives has to be carefully considered to make sure that not only Caitlin's but also Jamie's needs are met, and as you can imagine, they have very different needs. From the age of 4, we had to do daily exercises for something or other. It was occupational therapy, speech and language therapy, eye exercises, therapeutic listening, etc., etc. The list goes on for quite a while. Everything had to be planned in advance. I would produce visual guides or booklets to explain days out, visits to friends or holidays, and we've spent endless hours advocating for her education. And that's before all the research into her disabilities. I'd never even heard these terms before Caitlin was diagnosed. And the hypervigilance that is a constant when Caitlin is with us, because even at the age of 12, she can still do some rather strange things. I willingly spend time doing all these things because I see how much they benefit her, but it's the emotional strain that it puts on me that is probably the most difficult thing to manage. We spend so much time having to focus on the things that she can't do, on reports from professionals, reports from school, all of which serve to highlight the ways that she struggles to cope. Seeing her schoolwork is incredibly heartrending because I know how difficult it is for her to produce. I know how hard she tries and how frustrated she gets when the work is difficult for her. I have to constantly strive to see things from a different perspective. And for someone who's never been comfortable with difference, this has been excruciatingly hard. I've had to completely reframe what I consider to be success. And this is not helped by the fact that at school she is measured in the same way as all the other children who don't have any disabilities. And I'm going to show you a cartoon because I think this sums up what I mean in a very, very good way. So I hope you can all see that, but we have a group of animals who are being asked to climb a tree. Now, the monkey clearly is going to be able to do that, but I think the penguin and the elephant and the goldfish and the seal and the dog might struggle. And I love this quote from Albert Einstein saying that everybody is a genius, but if you judge a fish by its ability to climb a tree, it will live its whole life believing that it is stupid. Those of you who know Caitlin know how much she talks. And although we joke about it, it still upsets me when she does it, because for Caitlin, this incessant chatter is a sign of extreme and debilitating anxiety. I wrote this in my journal 2 years ago after one particularly difficult morning. Caitlin was so anxious. I know I should have done more preparation. I just forgot. Seeing her talk so much and seeing people's reactions to her is just excruciating. It hurts me in ways I didn't know I was capable of being hurt. I just want others to be able to see this amazing child I have and love her for who she is, chattiness and all. Being Caitlin's mum has brought up some very difficult feelings and memories for me, and I've suffered through recurrent bouts of depression and spent many, many hours in counselling, working through my feelings and trying to make sense of them and how they relate to being to my experience of being Caitlin's mum. And there are two areas that God has led me to focus on, particularly in the last couple of years. And the first one is that of forgiveness. I've learned the need to practice constant forgiveness. Every time Caitlin is misunderstood, every time she's the recipient of covert giggles or stares, every time she's excluded, every time she's rejected, every time a professional treats us like we don't understand our own child, every time they misquote what we've said, every time a friend complains about how her whole weekend is taken up by ferrying children to birthday parties, and I have to bite back a sarcastic retort about being sorry that her children are so popular. I've had to practice forgiveness instead. It isn't easy, and I frequently get it wrong, but I've also learnt the healing benefits of releasing the burdens of anger and resentment to God and choosing forgiveness instead. There are two quotes that have been really meaningful to me over the last few years, both from a lady called Sheila Walsh. The first is, "Forgiveness is God's gift to us to live in a world that isn't fair." What Caitlin has to endure isn't fair, and we'll never understand why. The second is, "Fair doesn't live here, but Jesus does." These have helped me through countless difficult situations, and letting go of hurt and resentment allows me to clearly see Jesus in our situation. The second area that has been a real struggle for me is grief. I did feel overwhelming grief when we first realised the significance of Caitlin's disabilities. But my first instinct was to tell myself that I was being ridiculous, that I should be thankful for the beautiful child I have, and that God created her to be who she is, and what right did I have to grieve over what God clearly thinks is right for our family? Constantly denying this grief over the years merely led to a lot of unresolved feelings and contributed to my depression and feelings of hopelessness. I thought that by feeling grief, I was admitting I didn't love Caitlin, which of course I do desperately. This grief presented itself as overwhelming jealousy through the years, and I found it incredibly difficult to be around other people with children of similar ages. I did it because most of our friends have similar age children, but it often left me feeling drained and resentful. I interpreted these feelings of jealousy as being ungrateful for what I had and therefore sinful. I spent a lot of time praying to God to remove these feelings, but they kept bubbling up. And I can remember one day in December 2013, I'd had a week of feeling really down leading up to that day. And I sat down to ask God if he could help me work out what was going on. And I wrote in my journal that I experienced a really strong feeling that it was related to the grief I felt over not having the daughter I had expected to have. For the first time, I was able to admit and face this grief, and I wrote the following in a prayer. Although I love Caitlin more than I can say, it is still a very different journey to the one I imagined. I acknowledged this wound for what it was, and God gradually began to heal me. I don't just grieve periodically, I live grief daily. Seeing Caitlin come out of school on her own when everyone else has company. Seeing that the phone numbers given to her by friends, well, supposed friends, are bogus. Being asked if she ever does XYZ with her school friends and having to admit that she has no friends at school. Helping her diligently prepare for an essay assessment, only to read what she's written and realise that it makes no sense at all and doesn't in any way resemble the essay she worked so hard to prepare. To look into her eyes as she comes out of school and see how she's nearly asleep. She is so weary. Turning down a social invitation because we know that her weekend homework will sap all her available energy. I could carry on, but I'm sure that you get the picture. I'm very thankful that through counselling and lots of prayer, God has taught me that it is far healthier to acknowledge these feelings of grief and let them go than to stuff them deep inside and just let them fester. I'm not sharing this dark side of my parenting journey because I want to garner sympathy, but rather because I want to create a level of understanding for people who have not been on this journey. I want our church to be a place where all children are loved and celebrated, no matter what their talents are. I want us to think before we judge, to acknowledge the amazing successes of these incredible children and their parents, even when that success may just be getting through the door of the church a few times a year. I want to break down those barriers that make it hard for people to ask about our children because they don't know what to say. That's okay. I don't expect you to know what to say. The important thing is that you show an interest and make the effort to understand. I would love to see these families that have a high level of extra stress supported in practical ways as well. Maybe a meal or offering to do some housework when you know that a friend is preparing for a big meeting at school, or even on the day as you tend to come out of those meetings emotionally spent and completely exhausted. Offer some suggestions as to how you would like to help and be persistent. I've found it incredibly hard to accept help over the years, which has been to my own detriment. Let people know that you care about what they're going through and that you're praying for them. I have several friends who are always willing to listen to my struggles and never get tired of hearing the same thing over and over again. Knowing that they are praying for me is such a source of strength and support. Don't just remind them to look after themselves. Offer to do something to help that happen. Offer to have their children for a couple of hours so that they can go for a walk or do some shopping or just sleep. What I love is when people make the effort to get to know my child. They ask how best to communicate with her, how to make a visit to their house less stressful for her. I don't want her to be treated the same as all the other children. It's not good for her, and it makes it harder for her to cope and enjoy life. What I do want is for people to understand the simple adaptations that can be made to make life less stressful for her. The other thing I would love to encourage is that we talk to our children about other children who have additional needs. I'm very aware that parents' views differ greatly on this, but for me, it's crucial to teach Caitlin's peers how they can help and support her and why she finds some things difficult. I believe that by doing this, we can encourage far more inclusion for our children, and their peers can learn the value of seeing the world from a different perspective. I would encourage you to talk to parents about how best to explain their child's needs to your own children or your grandchildren or your kids' own class. A small gesture, such as inviting a child over for a play date with your child, might just mean the world to them, especially if it's done in a way that suits that child. My most difficult experiences at church have been seeing Caitlin's peers point and giggle behind her back. Thankfully, not often, but it has happened. And maybe if all the children had a better understanding of additional needs, this wouldn't happen. I believe that the most important thing that any child can learn at church is not Bible stories, but about the love of Jesus, about being accepted and celebrated just for who they are, rather than anything they can do. As a church, I really believe we can be a vital source of encouragement and support for these families in a world that can sometimes feel quite isolated and lonely. Thank you for listening to us and for coming this evening. I now want to see if anybody's got any questions that you want to ask. Now is the time. Silence. No burn. Thelma. How it used to be. Yes, I think there's a lot of debate about why that is, but I think the common consensus is that a lot more people with high-functioning autism are being diagnosed now, whereas before it was really only people with classic autism that were being diagnosed. But there are a lot more people with high-functioning. It's not the classic autism, there hasn't been an increase in diagnosis, but high-functioning autism there has, and that seems to be what the general feeling is. Thank you, Isabel. Anybody else have any questions?
Can I tell the story that I thought this was made from?
You can.
It's an anachronism. The unexpected journey, there is a story which is told a lot in Amsterdam, so it's various different ways, about having a baby, it's like a holiday. And I'm going to Florence, and I get in the plane, and I go. Well, I don't have a plane.
Thank you, Isabel. I'm going to hand over to Lucy now, who's going to lead us in a short time of worship.